aliens and flying saucers.
Hey, what's up? Welcome to the 30th episode of Two Writers Slinging Yang. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm a former Sports Illustrated senior writer, former ESPN columnist, author of multiple New York Times bestsellers, and a columnist for The Athletic. The music you're listening to is Croissant's Master by the great MC White Owl. And this podcast is an ode to writing in all its forms, from journalism to songwriting to screenwriting to novels to romance to comics to whatever I'm thinking of. And today's guest is Joel Anderson, the ESPN.com senior writer, former BuzzFeed news writer, and a man who has done some absolutely extraordinary work in his career. Specifically, I want to talk with Joel about his long-form masterpieces. One, on Michael Sam and his father, wound up in the 2015 Best American Sports Writing. Another, about the bleak hometown of Earl Thomas of the Seattle Seahawks, that was written earlier this year for ESPN.com, will probably end up in the book as well. So let's go long and deep right now on Two Writers Slinging Yang. See, the secret is that there is no
secret. Joel.
Jeff.
You are my... So, as I told you, I like giving behind-the-scenes secrets here. So, This is my first time recording using Anchor as opposed to bumpers. And usually with bumpers, there's this long, hey, what's going on, blah, 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 blah. But we can't actually do that because we're into the podcast. So we're just going to have to talk without jabbering. Are you comfortable with it? Are you comfortable?
Yeah. Although I am really good at small talk, I'm willing to forego it, for this voyage here, this maiden voyage on Anchor.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Well, one thing I love about doing this podcast, or I've loved so far, is that it introduces me to a lot of writers that I weren't super familiar with. And I have to say, in all transparency, I was sort of midway through recording episodes, and a friend of mine named Miren Fader, who's a young writer for Bleacher Report, very good writer, said, "You should have Joel Anderson on." And I was like,
"Wow,
who's Joel Anderson?" And she's like, "Writer, blah blah blah." And then I started reading it. I'm like, "Oh my god, this guy's great!" So.
Wow.
That's like an insult. That's an insult compliment right there, because I didn't know who you were. But now I'm probably one of your biggest fans. So there you go.
Oh, man. I mean, I think it's that's who the hell I am at this point. And yeah, I never expected anybody to know. I mean, I know that I'm writing and I'm writing for, you know, like ESPN now. But sometimes you just forget that anybody knows who the hell you are, or that anybody even bothers to pay attention to a byline. So,
right. It'd be funny if I had the wrong Joel Anderson and you're actually like Joel Anderson, CPA, Connecticut CPA.
Or Joel Anderson, the California State Senator, who is the most famous Joel Anderson on Google.
Yeah, well, until this podcast.
Yeah, right. It's going to be at least the number two.
So I want to jump in here. I want to jump in with, it's very interesting. You write for ESPN and ESPN.com, ESPN the magazine. But until somewhat recently, you were writing for BuzzFeed News. And I'm reading the stuff you did for BuzzFeed News. I'm like, Jesus, this is, I'm almost like, this is the job I want to have. Right? For example, there's a piece you wrote in April of this year. A Georgia grandmother faced charges after she helped a black voter. And it's a fascinating, fascinating piece about, there was a woman named Diawana Robinson, who she was in Georgia, and she went to the local board of elections in Douglas, Georgia to vote. And she's standing in front of a voting machine and she doesn't know how to use it. And this woman, Olivia Pearson, who is a local civil rights activist and a longtime city commissioner, sort of comes to help her, doesn't tell her who to vote for, just says, "I see you're confused with the machine. Here's how you use it." Yep. And she ends up getting charged with a crime.
Yeah.
That, I mean, I guess I'm leading you in here. That seems like an insanely fascinating, riveting, and sort of rewarding kind of story to work on. Or am I misreading?
No, it absolutely. And it was a story I kind of came across by happenstance. I had a lot of self-loathing because I just felt like I had not contributed enough to the mission. And, you know, we're in the most pivotal election of our, you know, at least of my lifetime at this point. And I was like, man, I would like to write something. I want to do something. And so I said, well, you know, I don't see a lot of people talking about voter ID because, you know what election coverage is typically like. It's about the horse race and all that and about the personalities involved. So I said, well, you know, what can I add to voter ID? And so I had to sort of drill down and figure out, like, okay, where is a state where, you know, they're really cracking down on voter fraud, or, you know, they're, you know, prosecuting people for that, or, you know, there's these, you know, unduly restrictive laws that are preventing people from voting. And so I called, you know, a few places that, you know, nonprofits and organizations that deal with those issues. And I mean, man, I can't remember exactly, but there was somebody that they organization that works in the Southeast United States, and they were like, hey man, there's this woman that's going through a really tough time. Nobody's written about her. Maybe you should check it out. And that's actually how I got led to Olivia Pearson. And yeah, it just like really, it was exactly the sort of election story that I would want to write. And how it might affect, you know, the voting, you know, going into that election, and then how it affected her life afterward, which is the story you're talking about, the one from April, mm-hmm. which she actually went on trial. So, yeah.
And do you, when you're reporting a story like that, so here mm-hmm. you are, you're a man in America, mm-hmm. you're African American, mm-hmm. You've seen sort of how the justice system tends to work. How do you report a story like that and not let your, what I imagine must be some sort of outrage and a little bit of dumbfoundedness over how this is even happening, how do you not let that affect your reporting? Or is it okay for that to sort of affect your reporting?
Well, that's a good question. I feel like I am writing for people that are just sort of like, well, you know what? I kind of want to hear, you know, what happened here. People that are willing, like, I feel like I'm not going to reach people that in a story like that, that believe that voter fraud is like this massive, urgent issue in American politics. So I'm just like, what about the person that, like, you can distill it down to a single person? And so, like, when you're doing that, you have to be not detached, because you can never truly detach yourself. But I'm just like, well, I have to make the case that this is worth their time and that this is something that they should be concerned about. And so although I spend a lot of my day outraged about various things, particularly when I'm going to work, I have to sort of subdue that a little bit and just say, hey, well, look, I'm an attorney in a way, or, you know, I have to be sort of analytical about how I can get people interested in the story and to hear me out and see, did I make a case? Do you think that I made a case that Olivia Pearson is somebody that, you know, did not intentionally try to defraud the state of Georgia by helping people vote? And so, yeah, so I think that's kind of I have to go at it, because, you know, to do this sort of work, you know, I know that people are going to be skeptical of me. You know, like you said, I'm Black. You know, oftentimes the issues are right. Race and racism are at the center of them. And so people are not going to give me the shake at writing on this stuff that they would some other reporters, you know, tend to be white male. I'm going to say, well, Joel is coming in here biased. He's got an opinion on this stuff. And I do. But I also feel like if you look at my stories, I think it would be difficult for people to say, hey, look, he didn't really, really report this out and do the best that he could to be fair to both sides of the story.
You know, it's kind of crazy. I've covered sports. I graduated college in 94, so I've been covering sports for a long time and covering other things. And there's definitely a weird stigma that is attached to Black, especially male reporters, mm-hmm. and actually also in sports and women in mm-hmm. locker rooms, where I've heard far too many white reporters complain that they have an advantage. For example, well, he's Black and the guy he's interviewing is Black, or she's a young woman and she's 25 and she's pretty, so clearly he's going to talk to her. And I always think, like, nobody ever talks about the advantage I have with 98% of society, you know, like, no one ever says, wow, you're an advantage because you're a white guy and that guy's a white guy. That stuff drives me absolutely insane. It's such a preposterous, you know, in a way, yeah. I think it comes with a lot of weight, and sort of like you said, like, there's an expectation, totally unfair, but there's an expectation simply because of your race that you're going to be biased in a certain way to the story. And therefore, that probably makes you even far more aware of that and probably carry that weight more than I ever would.
Yeah. I mean, without you know, speaking to the sort of burden that you might have to feel when you're going to work personally, right? But yeah, you know, a lot of times I go into situations and the way that I actually think about it is in reverse. Like, because my primary beat at this point is college football, and it's not to, you know, cover X's and O's and, you know, talk about what Chip Kelly is going to do to revamp the UCLA offense or program or whatever. It's like to take, you know, sort of big picture issues and distill them into like a digestible story. A lot of times I go places, you know, I'm in press boxes, I'm in media conferences, and, you know, just as a black man, you just sort of, you become aware that, oh, wow, like, I'm the only black person here, you know?
Right.
And I'm like, you know, so if I'm trying to make sources with agents, coaches, athletic administrators, I you know, the fact of the matter is a lot of times I just don't get, I'm not able to get into those spaces in the same way that white male reporters are. And, you know, people tend to forget that. They look at me because I'm unique and I'm distinct when I come in there. And then, yeah, maybe sometimes a player may be a little bit more comfortable with me, or, you know, David Shaw might be a little bit more willing. You know, he may perk up a little bit if I show up and I ask him a question.
Right.
But on the whole, yeah, I, you know, the business is not set up for me to get in there and get the same sort of advantages. And I'm sure women would tell you much the same thing about going into a locker room. I mean, hell, I in an NFL locker room in years until I went to the Seahawks locker room maybe a couple months ago. And I was just like, dude, man, I was just like, you know, I was trying to picture like being a woman walking into this and how uncomfortable it may make them feel. I'm just like, you know, you don't know how people are going to regard you. You know, it's a really sensitive space within a professional, you know, within professional sports. And there's just all these other issues going on. And I'm just like, well, shit, man. I mean, what, I mean, being a pretty girl, I guess it's good, but I don't know that that's how you want to approach your work. I don't know if that's how you want your work to be boiled down to, that, okay, I'm a pretty girl, I'm going to get this story, because that could totally, you know, go in all sorts of other directions, you know?
Yeah, well, I also think, like, to me, when I've entered locker rooms, I kind of want to be invisible. Like, I don't want to be noted as the tall guy, the short guy, the black guy, the woman.
Yeah.
I just want to be invisible and be able to walk up to your locker and make my introduction. That's it.
Yes. Yeah, it's so awkward in there. Like, I was just like, God, this is really I remember thinking, I was like, I know that I don't want less access. Like, I think more access is better as a reporter and journalist. But, like, I wish there was some other way that we could do this where that we're not here. You know?
Oh, yeah.
Like, if they would just bring them out and we could talk to them afterward, or, you know, there was some sort of guarantee that we would get the same amount of time. Because I just don't want to be in there.
Let me ask you this. I want to throw this at you because I haven't actually done this with anyone. So, this is totally – I wasn't planning on this.
Right.
Describe to me why you hate the locker room. I hate the locker room.
Oh,
why? But I feel like a lot of people, a lot of listeners, if they're not reporters and they're not in sports, don't understand why we recoil at the and these people, because fans are like, oh man, you get to see David, right? It's like, trust me, it's not what you think.
Yeah, right. No, I mean, beyond the obvious, that people are walking around and they're naked, right? And you're like trying to avert your eyes, don't want to stare in one direction, you know, for too long. You're just trying to be like, you don't want to be weird, you know? It's like, hey, I'm just here to do work, I promise. You know, I don't, you know, I'm not taking pictures, I'm not, you know, gawking at you. There's nowhere to sit, for one. I mean, that's another thing. You know, you're just standing there and you're hoping that the person or the people that you're trying to talk to are going to show up, and that they're going to, you know, be there, and they're going to be dressed, and they're going to be in a good mood, because there's not even any guarantee of that. So it's a really informal atmosphere. You're waiting on somebody, and you got to wait for them to put their clothes on. And then you don't know if they're going to be in a good mood. And I guess it'd be akin to like going to somebody's, somebody's bedroom and doing an interview. And they're just like, hey, look, you know, just sit on the bed. It's fine.
You got five minutes.
Yeah, you don't mind. I've got pajamas on. I'm going to put on some underwear and, you know, get ready for the day here. Now, just, you know, make this quick. It's awkward. Like, I don't know what you, I mean, you've been in thousands of these things. I mean, and I think baseball clubhouses are like the worst of these, but like, it's gotta have been horrible for you, right?
Oh my God. I had one, I was covering the Seattle Mariners years ago, and I was, they had a relief pitcher named Ryan Franklin, and his locker was next to another reliever named Arthur Rhodes. And Arthur Rhodes wasn't around, and Ryan Franklin said, have a seat. So I'm sitting in Arthur Rhodes' chair. And oh, no. 5 minutes in, Arthur Rhodes is walking across the locker room. He's way on the other side of the locker room. And he goes, you, out of my chair. He wasn't even using the chair. Like, it's not like he was walking over to his chair. And Ryan Frankman just looks at me and is like, I don't know what to tell you, man. I mean, it's so humiliating.
Why didn't he say so? Why did he say, hey, man, I said it was okay? Like, that's the point where Ryan Frankman sort of came in and said, hey, man,
but
I
they
said
never
it was
do.
Cool. Yeah, right.
Never
right.
do.
They right, never right. Do. He set you up, man.
I know. So you alluded to being in Seattle. So the story that is, number one, twin to the top, pin to the top of your Twitter page is a piece you wrote for ESPN.com. Earl Thomas is a favorite son of a troubled Texas town, which came out a couple months ago. It's appeared in ESPN, the magazine. And I had a few interesting thoughts about the story, which I very much enjoyed. First, I'll read the lead real quick, which is just outside of Seattle, way up near the Forested. Snowfrost Peak of Cougar Mountain, Snowfrosted Peak of Cougar Mountain, Earl Thomas III stepped out onto the front yard of his 12 million six-bedroom home on a chilly November afternoon. Mm-hmm. Even today, 8 seasons into a career with the Seahawks that seems destined for NFL immortality, Thomas can barely believe he has made it all the way up, almost literally, to the top of the mountain. I was just standing out there, he recalls one recent morning, and I'm like, man, I'm in the mountains. I'm so blessed. And it's a really fascinating story about where he comes from, this small kind of racist Texas town, and now he's here in the Seahawks. But I was thinking when I was reading this story, I couldn't tell if Earl Thomas was very much help to you. And my guess was he wasn't. Or am I wrong?
No, you're right. Earl Thomas was the very last interview I did, and I didn't think it was going to happen. And I flew up to Seattle for basically 1 or 2 days because I'd spent most of my time in Orange, Texas. With his family and talking to people there. And there was just not a sense that Earl was going to help. And then finally, you know, the folks with the Seahawks, they said, okay, it's cool. You know, you can meet him after practice on Friday. And, you know, he's ready to do it. You'll get 20 minutes. And I'm just like, all right. But, you know, so, like, I'm flying from Houston to Seattle for 20 minutes after practice.
Which as a journalist, you're hoping is 30 to 40.
Yeah, right. I'm just like, well, maybe I can, like, you know, make him, like, I'm from Texas, too. We know some of the, you know, same landmarks. You know, maybe we know some of the same coaches. Like, maybe I can stretch this to an hour. So I get there, and they're like, oh, man, sorry to tell you, Earl left early.
Oh.
We don't know where he is or what's going on. And they say, you know, just hang out here for a little bit. Maybe he'll come back. 2 or 3 hours later, the Seahawks dude is like, yeah, man, I'm sorry. Earl just totally forgot. He's got something else to do now. And, you know, maybe you can get in tomorrow. And my flight was scheduled to leave, like, you know, like that evening. So I'm just like, well, shoot, man. So I had to reschedule my flight for the next day. I show up again that morning, Saturday morning, and he bailed on me again. And I was just like, oh, God, like, this is just not going to happen. But the ace in my hole was that I had contacted his mother, and I just said, well, it doesn't look like it's going to happen. And she's like, oh, really? What's going on? Blah, blah, blah. And so then, you know, a couple hours later, they're like, okay, Earl says you can come up to his house. It's close to practice, and, you know, you'll get some time with him there. And I'm just like, what? And, I mean, obviously, I suspected that his mother had done that, but I didn't confirm it until after the interview. So anyway, I get there.
Wait, you drove to his house?
I drove to his house from the Seahawks facility. So I think that the practice facility is in Renton. And his house is, like, near Bellevue. It is in Bellevue, but, like, on top of Cougar Mountain. It's like a 15-minute drive. It's not that bad. And so, yeah, I get there. He opens the door and lets me in. And he didn't, like, his wife is in there, his, like, I think 3 or 4 year old daughter's in there. His mother-in-law's in there. He just walks me right past him. Doesn't even introduce me. He's just like, all right, come on, we're going upstairs. We go upstairs to his, what he calls his man cave, which is, you know, huge TV, big chairs, lots of signed jerseys, you know, Brandon Marshall, you know, Jamal Charles, all these dudes. And so he sits at one end of the couch. I sit at the other. And I actually was able to stretch it out for an hour. And he was not bad. What I got him, right? Like, but it was just that hour, and I never got a sense that I knew who he was as a person, or, you know, we didn't get close. I would never pretend that, like, we got close or anything. But that hour was better than I thought, and I was just like, well, man, I actually got inside this dude's house, which, you know, the Seahawks folks say never happens. And I was like, well, you know, this is I've got the lead with this because, like, this is the action. This is something new. And it sort of it showed the difference, even though he didn't tell me a lot. It shows the difference, at least, and the distance that he made from Orange, Texas to Seattle, which, I mean, you know, you probably couldn't find two more different places in this country than those two right there. So
this might be a weird question, but does it say anything to you as a writer and as an observer or chronicler or whatever you want to call yourself? You enter his house and he doesn't introduce you to anyone. And does that say anything to you?
Yeah, well, I think it's a testament to how guarded he is, right? And, you know, I also think that he sort of is, man, I don't want to be a psychologist, but I just sort of think that a lot of his life has been about him, you know, that, you know, he is the gravitational force for even Orange now, not just his family, but Orange. So when people go there, they're looking to talk to him. They're writing about him. It's all about him. And his brother worked for him. You know, he funds a lot of what his parents do. He retired his parents. He, you know, does a lot of things for the town. You read the story. So I could totally see him being like, well, you're here to talk to me. Like, wait, right. you're not here to get to know my family. Like, I've done all this. This is about me. And yeah, also I don't want you talking to my wife. I don't want you talking to my kids. Like, that, you know, you've already talked to my parents. Like, why would I do that? Like, it was clear that we were not going to, it was always going to feel like, you know, just sort of a professional interaction. Like, we were never going to get anything approaching friendly. 'Cause I tried that a couple times. Like, we're sitting at his house. You know, he goes to University of Texas. I'm from, I went to college at Texas Christian University. That day, UT was playing TCU. And I just tried to make a little joke about it. And he's like, yeah, bro, I'm going to watch that game. Like, you know, it was it. He just kind of died there. I was like, okay, well, I guess he doesn't want to have small talk either. So, yeah.
Wait, 20 years in journalism, I can translate that to shut up and ask me the questions you have to ask me.
Right. Exactly. And it was like, no, like, I had the questions I wanted to ask him. And I tried, you know, to stretch it out a little bit. But, like, there was never going to be a chance that we were just going to, like, oh, you know this person, you're from here, I know this person, blah, blah, blah. It was never going to be that. Not, I can respect that. Like, you know, there, he had nothing to gain by talking to me, and I try to remember that all the time when I talk to people. For the most part, most people have nothing to gain by talking to me. So I just try to respect that, at least, you know?
Do you feel like his sort of, not cold shoulder, but his sort of limited interest in the story impacted the story one way or another? Like, Thea giving you 5 hours and toured you around Texas, is it a completely different and better? I mean, I think it's an excellent story, so it's not a criticism. Do you feel like it could have been a better story? Do you like how the story came out? Do you feel like all in it?
You know, yeah, I would have liked for him to have talked with me a little bit more and like, hey, look, I want you to talk to this person. And, you know, like,
here's my wife.
Yeah, here's my wife. You know, she moved to Orange from New Orleans after Katrina, and I met her then, and you know, she could talk a little bit about like how Orange helped save her family and, you know, gave them a second life or any of that stuff, but like that just didn't happen. And so, yeah, I do think that there was some holes in it. And I mean, there's a couple of things to that. One, he said some things about Orange that I didn't expect him to say. Like, I didn't expect him to say Orange place. Like, you know, usually people are a lot more defensive about where they come from, especially somebody like him who's poured so much time and resources into it, right? But he was very circumspect. He's like, you know, I'm not raising my family there. His parents didn't know that. His parents did not know that he felt that way. I, in a way, as I look back on it and I look at how the rest of his season is gone, I thought that he may have used that interview as a way to let people know, hey, I'm pulling back now. You know, I think that, you know, I've done a lot for people, but, you know, this is my way of letting you know that, you know, I'm sort of moving forward. You can just see, I mean, the last week, you know, he walked up to the, you know, Jason Garrett and said, hey, come get me. Like, it's just the things that he's doing this year. It just, that interview, if you had been there for that interview, what he did with Jason Garrett after that game would make a little bit more sense, you know? So
do you feel like these guys are aware, like Earl Thomas? You said he didn't need you needed him, which is true. The trophy room with the framed jerseys, the sort of I am the center of the universe sort of thing that so many athletes and celebrities I've interviewed over the years across all spectrums carry with them. Do you feel like these guys are prepared for life after sports?
Oh man. No, but how could anybody be, you know? I mean, I was a nobody. You know, I played college football very briefly and poorly. And, you know, you spend a lot of your life, like, growing up. I mean, somebody like Earl Thomas, who's, you know, closing in on 30, and would have spent, you know, what, two-thirds, four-fifths of his life playing football, and people and, you know, making sure that, you know, he focuses on that and hones that craft. And that's how he's known. He goes into town, his jerseys and, you know, local restaurants and have an Earl Thomas day. And so, like, when that focus is off of you, I don't know how, like, how you find another identity or even, like, other interests. Like, because you really don't have a lot of time if professional football or any professional sport is your, you know, your the way you're moving through the world. Like, I mean, how do you have time to find out, hey, you know, also maybe I'm interested in being a geologist, or, you know, I would like to be a, you know, I'd like to go back to school and finish this. Like, some guys are like that. A lot of guys are like that. But if you're somebody like Earl Thomas, like, how much time could you actually, to be as good as he is at that sport, you just, there probably isn't a lot of time for, like, this is what else I want to do, right, when this is over, or a sense of how it actually will be when it's over, because it probably feels a lot different than those guys think it's going to feel, you know, retirement, I mean.
Yeah, one of my favorite, or most memorable moments from different books is I interviewed a guy, Dallas Cowboys used to have a defensive back named Clayton Holmes, and when he was with the Cowboys, he was in a bar with Tony Dorsett, and someone offered to buy Clayton Holmes a drink, a stranger, and Clayton Holmes said, "Nah, don't worry about it," and Tony Dorsett turns to him and says, "Never turn down a drink because they're going to forget you sooner than you think." And I was like, you know, like,
wow.
Earl Thomas is Kenny Easley. Most people would not recognize Kenny Easley walking around.
Yeah.
You know, and they do forget you. And I just think it's an interesting, I am fascinated by the evolution that athletes have to go through from being athletes to not being athletes, because I think it's one of the hardest falls we witness as people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, most of these guys, I mean, there are a few, right, that is sort of like the string it out, right? And they can be who they are forever. Well, not who they are forever, but like a version of that. And people.
You can be Harold Reynolds and have a great career in broadcasting and basically get relatively the same high you had playing for the Seattle Mariners. But that does not happen very often.
Yeah, right. And I think about guys, like, even though their lives are, like, notoriously hard and, you know, they're suffering in their post-career lives, but like Herschel Walker is still Herschel Walker,
right?
Like, that name means something to a lot of people, even though his life is difficult, and he can go anywhere and get recognized and people will sort of fawn over him, but like, that's probably not happening for Garrison Hurst, you know.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And you know what's funny, I did a story recently for The Athletic about Thomas Jones, the former Jets halfback, and Thomas Jones ran for more than 10,000 yards in his career. He played in the Super Bowl, he was a Pro Bowler. If his name, he's remembered by almost no one. If his name were Thaddeus McDougal, he'd be like, holy cow, it's Thaddeus McDougal.
Right.
Like Herschel Walker. I think there's something just about the name Herschel Walker that people remember in and of itself.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, man, yeah. It's funny because I don't even think of Thomas Jones as the famous Jones brother. I don't know why I think Julius Jones is the more famous Jones brother. Like, stats don't even hold that up. But, yeah, like, most of the – It helps if, like, I mean, Jalen Rose, you know, like, that's a guy that you'll remember forever. And I think that does help. Like, you just have, like, a little bit of a personality and a name, and it just sort of resonates with people forever. But, yeah, like, Earl Thomas, you know, Michael Griffin, you know, guys like that. Like, you know, they're just, they were great, and, you know, then they'll just fade into anonymity. And they won't even be able to really trade on their names in the same way when it's all over because of that, you know, because of that sort of anonymity, right?
Yeah, so. It's weird. You wrote another story that I absolutely loved, and it got you in the Best American Sports Writing. It was also for BuzzFeed. The two Michael Sams. Michael Sam Jr. doesn't talk to his father. This is the subhead. Michael Sam Jr. doesn't talk to his father, who's been caricatured in the press as an anti-gay man who abandoned his family. But there's a lot more to the story. This is a riveting, riveting, sad story by Michael Sam's dad, who lives in sort of an assisted living nursing home type facility. He's only in his 50s. He's clearly beaten down by life and kind of set aside. And what made you write it?
Man, you know, originally when I was at BuzzFeed, we were really, really trying to like write a story about the first out gay football player. Like, we knew that that was a story that was going to be big. We have, at that time, you know, BuzzFeed News was really, LGBT News was like a big emphasis of our company. And so they're like, hey, look, we really want you to be on this beat and to try to develop it and get stuff on it. And I was like, all right, cool, you know. And so we got a tip that there was going to be a football player that was going to come out, or, you know, announced that he was gay. And we just barely missed out on that to ESPN and the New York Times.
Okay.
And so because of that, we were just like, crap. Like, you know, we reported it maybe like an hour after they did. Like, we had the name. We were just waiting to get confirmation on it. So anyway, as a result, like, we just sort of followed the coverage after that. I was like, we're going to come back to this. We're going to take a bite at that apple at some point. And, you know, I think what sort of crystallized was that when he got drafted and, you know, ESPN was there with him and he's celebrating with his family. You know, not with his family. He was celebrating with some people and his boyfriend at the time. Yeah. And they're all in this room. And I was just like, yo, there are no black people in that room. Like, where is his family?
So interesting.
I mentioned that to my editor at the time. And he was like, oh, well, I think that's our story. Like, we're. What has happened to Michael Sam's family? Where are they? And he talked about how difficult it was. And so that's just sort of what made us look into it at that point.
All right. So how do you find the dad? How do you go about it?
It's crazy. So, you know, I think I mentioned, and I'll, you know, if you know me, you know, for 3 minutes, I'll tell you that I'm from Houston, Texas. We just said, well, you know what, let's go down to his hometown and let's figure out, you know, like, what's going on with him. And so Houston is like maybe 45, 50 minutes away from Hitchcock. So I drove down from New York to Houston, basically packed up my bags. And I was like, well, I'm going to, you know, maybe I'll get 3 weeks to a month on this story. And I, you know, I won't have to pay for a hotel. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the company won't complain too much. And so anyway, I just kind of started knocking on doors. And, you know, I did a little research, found out that his was originally from Lamar, Texas, which was, you know, sort of close to Hitchcock. It's just right across the freeway from it. And so I was just driving around, talking to people where his whole, you know, found out where his old family home was and just started talking to people in the streets there. And they were like, hey, you know, I know Michael Sam's aunt. And she turned out to, I think she was the first black female mayor of that. She invited me in. We talked to her and I talked to her and she's like, hey, I don't think that, you know, Mike's dad is going to talk to you. Like, I really don't. He felt really burnt by some of these other interviews and, you know, but you can try. So, I at that point it gets kind of murky. I can't remember, but I found out that he was living at that assisted home in Dallas, and so I stopped by his brother's place, which is also in Dallas, and he's like, "Hey, man, let's go on over. Let's go see Mike right now." And I was like, "Oh, great, cool. Well, let's do this."
Are you nervous when this happens? Is there any anxiety in you when you're driving?
Oh. All the time.
Yeah.
Like, I'm nervous the entire time. Like, I'm just, you're just like, how are people going to receive me? Like, what is, you know, what's going to, I'm knocking on people's doors, which is a sort of, you know, weird in and of itself. Like, I don't know about you. I don't answer my door typically, especially if I don't know who it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, I'm knocking on doors and people are just welcoming me in and giving me a chance to make the case. And so his brother welcomed me in and we sat down and talked for an hour and had a lot in common. It was just very friendly and really cool. And he's just like, hey, well, shoot, you want to go see Mike? Let's go see Mike. And he made the mistake of calling Mike before we went over.
Yeah.
And he was like, no, I'm not doing that. But anyway, he said, the brother was like, well, you know what? If you go over there and you bring him a bowl of gumbo, I bet he'll talk to you.
That's easy enough.
Yeah. Yeah. So the next day I went and got some gumbo, walked right into the nursing facility. Like, nobody stopped me. I just went, like, I knew where I was going. Mm-hmm. And went to his room and sat down. And he, you know, maybe for the first hour, he's like, who are you? What is this about again? I think he was under the influence of whatever painkillers or drugs he needed for his condition. And it's kind of let him clear his head. And he napped for a little bit. So that just went on for like 3 hours. And finally, you know, when he was up and ready to go, we talked for a little bit and I just kept going back. Day after day after day. And that story from conception to finish probably took about 6 months.
Whoa.
So, yeah.
Wow. Now, I mean, one thing I find interesting in this career, I've brought this up on past podcasts, is I always, as I get older especially, I am increasingly nervous about, quote unquote, taking advantage of people.
Yeah.
Meaning, here's this guy, he doesn't have much money, his son got drafted, you want him to talk, you bring him the gumbo, because I would do the same thing, because you know it's going to help your case. Is there a line that you cannot cross when trying to get someone to open up to you? Or is it just a free-for-all and you can do whatever the hell you want?
Man, you know, that's a good question. I mean, you have to kind of take it on a case-by-case basis, right? What I told Mr. Sam was that, you know, I think, and I told the family, I was like, I don't know if anybody actually knows who you are beyond these quotes where you talked about that, you know, you don't, you know, you hope that your son, that you had a difficult time accepting that your son was gay, and all this other stuff. Like, you know, I don't know if anybody knows anything about you beyond that, or the sort of father that you were to him. Like, you know, nobody knows. Like, Michael clearly is an exceptional young man. That didn't come from nothing. What role did you play in it? And I was like, you know, this is your chance to tell your story. I was like, somebody is going to tell this story. You should, you know, let me make the case that it should be me. Yeah. And I said, nobody's going to care about it like I am. I mean, I'm from this area. You know, I know a lot of the people that you guys know. I'm going to be very careful with this. And I'm going to spend the time. I was like, I have the time and I have the resources to do this. And so, you know, I'm not going to force anybody to talk, but I'm just going to, like, if you keep talking, I think that, you know, this can be sort of an interesting story. And, you know, it is with anything, you know, they felt that they had been boxed out. You know, they felt that that the national media had been unfair to them, and, you know, Michael had sort of cast them as like these rubes and homophobes and bigots, and, you know, that he was saved, when he went off to college and moved away. And so, you know, through their resentment, I think they helped to tell that story. And even as they're telling that story, I'm like, you know, Michael, you know, has his version of events too, and he's entitled to that. But I just thought that it would help to tell little bit more of a fuller story. I think you originally asked, like, what's the line? I don't know. It's hard for me to say what it is, but I didn't feel like I was taking advantage of them. Sometimes I'm trying to think of a time where I've been in that situation, and generally you just tend not to. If you're a bad reporter, that'll come across, right? Or if your editors don't help you, if the story conception is bad, it'll become clear that you took advantage of somebody. But thankfully I've had good editing and people to help me. And I try to, you know, especially if a story I'm not as familiar with, or I feel a little weird about, I try to get help from people I trust to walk me through it so that I'm not like burning people, you know?
Actually, I feel like in my career, I had one instance where I was a young writer. I was at Sports Illustrated. And I was trying to figure out what the hell happened to Josh Hamilton, who at the time, he was a Rays prospect and he kind of vanished. And the Rays weren't talking. So I went down to interview the GM of the Rays and a bunch of people. And I told them all I was doing a story about the Rays young outfielders. And the truth of the matter is I was doing a story about one of the Rays young outfielders who was there. And I was trying to figure out why. And I feel like I was haunted by that for a long time because I lied. I was full of shit. I wasn't doing a story about the young outfielders. I was doing a story about Josh Hamilton. And years later, I apologized to the PR guy because I was probably 26 and just like so desperate to kind of make it and make a name for myself that I crossed a line that I feel like I really shouldn't have crossed. And I hate that I did that, you know?
So yeah. No, man. You wrote about, I mean, obviously everybody knows about the John Rocker thing. Yeah. But you wrote about that like afterward too, about how you felt about what that story made him out to be and like what it did for your career, right? Like, I mean, that was something you sort of grappled with as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, I just hate, I don't like the idea of, number one, I don't like becoming part of the story. And like that was a profile of John Rocker. That's why I was sent there. It wasn't about the reporter who wrote about John Rocker. And then number two, I hated that he was suspended because of that, because I thought, yeah, he's awful. But if you're going to insist that these guys give access to the media, they're not all going to share my views. They're just not.
Right.
And some of these guys are from Macon, Georgia, and they're white guys from Macon, Georgia, and they're using and I'm not saying it's cool, but if you suspend everyone who doesn't share your beliefs or doesn't use the words that you choose, you're going to be suspending a lot of guys if they're open about themselves. So I thought the punishment for him should have been the public humiliation of being a racist. I thought,
yeah,
you know, so.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. Yeah, like, you don't want to intercede in such a way that it, if any, even if it's somebody you don't necessarily like or agree with, I'm not writing about them to burn them or to ruin their lives. Because, right, it's like they're doing me a favor. Like, they're welcoming me into their lives. Like, it's really intimate. Most people don't have anybody come into their life and ask them questions about their life. So that's like a real, it's a real intimate transaction. And so no matter who you're writing about, like, you just don't want to leave them worse off than you were. I mean, you know, I mean, unless, you know, they're running some sort of like pedophilia ring or something, right? But like, that's
really not happening. It's kind of a catch-22 because you're writing, all right, so you're writing about a guy like Rocker, just as an example here, and he's this racist, horrible human being. Like, he's horrible. And he's giving you all this information. So, and you know, you work hard to find out who people are in this business. That's the whole thing, is trying to figure out who they are and them opening up to you and, you know, going to visit Earl Thomas and visit his family. So hopefully he'll open up to you. And so then a guy opens up to you and it turns out he's an asshole and you have to write that he's an asshole. Well, his life is going to end up worse because of that. But I don't know what the solution is to that problem, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, and I mean, sometimes, you know, it's different, right? Because you know, some people are more savvy about what they're saying and what's going to happen to their life as a result than others.
Yes.
And so, like, yeah, I feel you feel bad according to that, like, or you know, you feel how you feel about the story according to that scale. Like, it doesn't, and it can't prevent you from doing your job, but it's just something that you think about because you're like, oh, there's like, this is a person here. And I tend to feel that way more about like people that like have jobs.
Sure.
You could be taken away from them than like a professional athlete, obviously.
So. Well, I always say to my kids, you never want to make someone's life harder because of your presence. I say that all the time. So, like, I never want to complain about a bad meal, a dirty fork, bad service, unless it is just so egregiously awful that I'm personally offended, because I don't want someone to lose their job on account of me.
Oh, yeah. You know? Absolutely. Yeah. No, I think about that. Like, you know, you go to a restaurant or whatever and you're like, oh man, the service is bad, but how do I know that it's not, you know, that they're backed up in the kitchen and it's not that dude's fault, or, you know, he has like all these other tables and this other table is making it difficult. Yeah, no, totally. I'm very, and I think I mentioned this in one of our texts, like, I'm very aware of like what my presence is. And so I'm always apologizing for like imposing upon people or infringing upon them in any way. And so that also can carry over to work too.
Yeah, I feel you. Let me ask you a final thing that I'm fascinated by. You mentioned knocking on doors, and I feel like over the past 2 years, I've knocked on more random doors than I did the entirety of my career. For me personally, so what I always do when I knock on a door, I always bring a copy of one of my books. I always write a long note. I put it by it because I want to be able to say immediately, look, I'm not just some cuckoo at the door. My heart is beating a million times per minute. My hands are sweaty. I have no idea what's coming, but I feel like it's a very, very effective way of getting someone to talk.
Yeah. Right. No, absolutely. Because most people don't, it's so easy to ignore an email or a phone call, you know, and especially if it's a phone call, like, you're just a voice. If it's an email, you know, you're just a few little letters in their inbox. But like, if you show up at somebody's house, like, it shows that like, you've got, like, you have a real incentive to talk to this person, that like, you've gone through this effort, this massive effort to show up at their house, and it's that much more serious. And so it's harder to look somebody in the face and turn them away, like, no matter what, like, unless you're like me, in which case you don't answer your door at all. But and so that's why I try to do that all the time. I actually did that. You know, it's weird. I don't know if you've had this experience before, but I don't know if that doesn't happen a lot in sports journalism, because so much in sports happens away from homes and like private spaces for athletes. So it usually happens on their terms. And so they're sort of discombobulated if you show up at their house or their family's house, because it's just that you're stepping outside of, you know, this artificial bubble they've got around them. So I try to do it at all times. Like, as soon as I'm writing about somebody, I look them up in Nexus. And I'm looking at all the people that are connected to them, you know, family member, brothers, cousins, father, but, you know, wife, ex-wife, whatever. And as much as possible, given resources and time, I'm trying to hit those people up and show up at their door, or at least give them a call.
And the funny thing is, we basically have parallel lives here. I use Nexus too, and for people who don't know, Nexus is an incredible database for finding addresses and phone numbers. But the catch over the past few years is it only gives home numbers and nobody answers their home phones anymore.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'm always knocking on doors.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. Like, that's the whole, yeah, right. Because people don't have landlines anymore. And, you know, the cell phone records are, like, notoriously spotty. So, yeah, yeah. That, like, going to the house is, like, pretty much the best way to ensure that you're going to be able to get it done. And, I mean, if you can do it as a reporter, and it's a blessing to have the resources and the time to show up at somebody else's house. Like, I'm not going to make it seem like I'm special. I just had the time and I had the resources to do it. And so, like, that's why I do it. And if you can do it as a reporter, I highly encourage anybody that's listening to this to do it if you can. So.
Until someone gets shot or something.
My God.
Wait, I got to tell you, I did a story last year for Bleacher Report about I got a basketball player named Bryce DeJean Jones, who he played for the New Orleans Pelicans, and he was shot and killed in Dallas. And I.
Yeah. You wrote that's right. I did. Yeah. That was a great story, man. Well,
thank you. But I knocked on the shooter's door. And
oh, God.
I'm sitting there knocking the door, and I'm thinking, I really am thinking, my hands are coated in sweat, and I'm thinking, the last time someone knocked on this guy's door, he shot through it. You know, like, it's a weird thing. It's weird. And it ended up working out, actually. But it is not for the – it is not – I'm not saying I'm a tough guy. I'm not, like, you know, whatever, Rambo or anyone even remotely tough. But, like, it is not for the faint of heart to go knocking on a stranger's door hoping they talk to you, because it can be very intimidating, I think.
Oh, yeah. What is does your family, like, you know, wife or whatever, like, she's terrified of you doing these things, right?
She hates it. And I always tell her, right. I always give her the exact address where I am before I do it, just in case, you know.
Oh,
just,
that's smart.
Yeah. So
I need to start doing that too. Now that's, you just gave me a tip. I want to start doing that.
Yeah, you should. You can always text me, Joe.
Now we got each other's number. We should definitely.
Well, listen, it's been seriously delightful having you here. I'm a big admirer of your work. I think this stuff is great. And I wish you much luck in 2018 at ESPN.
Oh, man, Jeff, thanks so much. You're a legend, man. Thanks for giving me a call. I appreciate it, man.
Thanks, Joel.
I'm going to take it easy.
I want to thank today's guest, Joel Anderson, for joining me on Two Riders Slingin' Yang. You can follow Joel on Twitter at @ByJoelAnderson and read his stuff at ESPN.com. One can listen to Two Riders Slingin' Yang on both iTunes and now on Anchor.fm. Reviews are always appreciated. The music is by the sizzling MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. Happy New Year. And remember, keep writing.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.